and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, we've applied to the magistrate court and got a response that the matter can only be heard on the 11th of July, which is a date after our launch. And that's why we've immediately done an agent application to the High Court so that we seek redress.
Zimbabwe's main opposition party files a court petition seeking to reverse a police crackdown on its campaign launch.
Torture and police brutality in Zambia, it's a legacy issue. We have suffered police brutality since the beginning of this country.
The Zambian Civil Liberties Union is calling for a new law against torture in the Southern African country.
We have a number of teachers who were recruited and have not been deployed under the excuse of saying the government does not have money.
And a group says plans by the Ugandan government to employ about 3,000 new teachers are unlikely to resolve the shortage of teachers. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwe, the main opposition party, Citizens Coalition for Change, has filed a court petition seeking to reverse a police crackdown on its campaign launch in Bindura, about 53 miles outside the capital, Harare. The opposition party says this is another attempt by the police to restrict its activities in the run-up to the August general election, citing problems including the lack of sewer facilities and accessible water with the venue in Bindura. The police blocked the campaign launch. But the opposition says it's part of a plan to prevent the group from campaigning, an accusation the police deny. Gift Ostalo Siziba is the national deputy spokesperson for the Citizens Coalition for Change. He tells me that the group had to seek legal redress after the police kept restricting the party's activities ahead of the elections.
We have entered the election season, and naturally, there was not supposed to be an application to the police, but just a notification of our rallies. But to the surprise, is that the first thing is that we were given a venue by the city council, and the town clerk was compelled not to give us a venue, but clearly by an operation of the regime in Harare. And after we looked for an alternative venue and clearance from the owners, we've just been briefed by the police that our rally launch can proceed. And this is happening at the background of other 3-4 rallies that have been banned, interrupted, disrupted by ZANU-PF thugs and using also the police, which is obviously a very terrible, you know, trend, particularly in the fact that we are less than 50 days from the election and we can't officially launch our campaign under these circumstances because the police is being used as a willing tool to try and disorganize and directly attack and suppress our fundamental rights to assembly.
I understand your organization has approached the court to seek legal redress. Is this the case?
Yeah, we've applied to the magistrate court and got a response that the matter can only be heard on the 11th of July, which is a date after our launch. And that's why we've immediately done an agent application to the High Court so that we seek redress because ZANU-PF cannot stop us. ZANU-PF cannot stop the winds of change in this country. Mm-hmm. That's why you see them clutching on straws, running from hook, line and sinker to try and make sure that we don't proceed with our political programming. But we're very clear. We received well in Kutu. Just now we left rural Kutu in the countryside of Masvingo province. The people are very clear. People expect change, but they understand that we're doing it at the background of very unfair conditions. We're doing it at the background of an autocratic regime that has suspended the constitution.
But some people are suggesting that the reasons the police gave for which you cannot proceed with the planned launch is because of security reasons and that it's unsafe. There's no water, there's no other proper amenities that would ensure safety of those who will come. Isn't this a fair assessment for you to reconsider the venue of this launch?
No. This is a very misunderstood position. The political decision that is coming from the desk of ZANU-PF is that we should not conduct any rally in Mashara and Centra, which they say is their stronghold. That is the fundamental strategic point from ZANU-PF. Number two is that the reason given by the police that there are no roads, well, that is their primary reason. But there are no roads everywhere in this country. ZANU has destroyed our country. There are no roads anyway. There is no road network in different parts of the country, particularly in the countryside. Secondly, the issue of abolition facilities is a problem all over the venues that are being used by anyone and everyone. And that's why we hired mobile abolition facilities, because we are conscious. We've done that before. That is what we do in all our public meetings, because we're a responsible movement, we're a responsible political organization. And that's why you see us also establishing to make sure that our security personnel, more than 200 of our security personnel, have already manned the venue that we're supposed to be using. So there is no any justification under MOPA that should stop us from gathering.
Well, there are suggestions that there is a level playing field and that this is just a mere publicity stunt just to embarrass the government, make the government unpopular, as well as accuse the police unjustly in the run-up to the elections.
We are patriotic Zimbabweans. We all bear our loyalty to the skies and our loyalty to the flag of this country. How will we tarnish our image when the regime of Mr. Mnangagwa is the one that has unleashed its central intelligence organization to pounce on our supporters in the countryside? How do we become how do we tarnish the image of our country when ZANU-PF under Mr. Mnangagwa is the one that has arrested our leaders? As I'm speaking to you right now, our MP has been in prison for more than a year now, Honorable Job Sikala. He committed no crime, but he's been arrested and he's not been given his right to bail and a fair trial. You know, so all these circumstances are proving that we have no new dispensation in Zimbabwe under Mr. Mnangagwa.
What's the next line of action now?
Now we will wait for the High Court so that we continue with our meetings, because we don't expect that if ZANU-PF can detect how we conduct our political programs.
Gift Ostalos Siziba is the National Deputy Spokesperson for the Citizens Coalition for Change. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The Zambian Civil Liberties Union is calling for a law against torture in the southern African country. It says allegations of torture must be investigated and those responsible prosecuted as a deterrent. The group also wants the government to help with the prosecution of police officers who engage in acts of torture, now under investigation by the International Criminal Court, or ICC. The remarks come after a suspect, Maxwell Mwila, died in police custody. This after the police have often come under criticism for using excessive force against unarmed civilians when carrying out arrests, accusations the police deny. Maurice Makalu is the Deputy Executive Director of the Zambian Civil Liberties Union. He tells me that his organization is prepared to assist the Hague-based International Criminal Court to prosecute perpetrators of torture in Zambia.
We received a report that somebody died in police custody, and there have been a lot of reports currently in the media, and we have talked to a number of victims who have suffered torture at the hands of the police. So when we received the report of a death in police custody, we got interested and dug out some information, gathered some information, and we are calling on the police to explain the circumstances under which this suspect died, because currently there's a total silence from the police. We don't know if it's because the individual involved is of no big name, because even the torture reports that are currently covered in the media is of highly reputed people, politicians.
Activists are calling for a full-scale investigation into the death, because they said there have been recent allegations of police brutality and that the death of this young man is a cause for the police administration or an independent body to investigate this. Is this the stance of your organization as well?
Yes. You know, torture and police brutality in Zambia is, I can call it, it's a legacy issue. We have suffered police brutality since the beginning of this country, maybe under the one-party state of Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. May his soul rest in peace. And we have a situation where currently we don't have a law against torture. Article 15 of our constitution protects against torture, inhuman or degrading punishment and like treatment, but we don't have an enabling law. So what we have is pervasive impunity by the police to treat suspects whichever way they want. And they brutalize, they beat, they torture. Some people say they get even tortured on their private parts and such allegations. So we have a culture of impunity in the police. That's why our stand is to call for, even we are prepared to work even with international organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. We are prepared to work with them because in the absence of a law locally that we can use to prosecute perpetrators of torture in our courts here, we can resort to the International Criminal Court that has got universal jurisdiction on the prosecution of torture.
Well, some people are also suggesting that perhaps this gentleman could have died, probably could just be an accident. So why should the whole police command be put under such stress or pressure?
Well, the facts we have gathered are very evident that there was brutality. We have testimony of relatives of the young man who identified him at the police station where he died, who are testifying that they found him in a pool of blood. And that's why we are even calling on the police to hold a press conference. We would prefer a press conference and not just a statement because, you know, in a press conference, there would be a back and forth. The press would ask questions and seek clarification and all those things instead of just a press statement and then the police are hiding behind the statement. We would want them to clear the name of the police.
What's the next line of action for your organization?
If we had a statute currently in Zambia which dealt with torture, we would have taken up the case ourselves because one of the things that we do is to undertake litigation. We take the government to court or whoever has breached anybody's rights or broken any law that applies to the areas we operate in. So if the police do not issue the press statement and clarify their issues, we will continue gathering information. We will talk about other issues of torture other than just this gentleman who passed away in police cells. And once we have gathered the facts, we will consider the next steps. Our goal is to try and have some example of what happens to somebody who tortures another person.
Maurice Makalu is the Deputy Executive Director of the Zambian Civil Liberties Union. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Obstetric fistula is one of the most serious and dangerous injuries pregnant women go through during childbirth. According to the World Health Organization, more than 2 million young women go untreated in Asia and Africa. This week on Our Voices, we'll explore the cause of fistula, discuss prevention, as well as reintegration of women back into their communities. Join the conversations Wednesday at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
In Senegal, a leading civil society leader says pressure from activists may have contributed to President Macky Sall's decision not to seek an unprecedented third term. Denis Ndour, vice president of the Senegalese Human Rights League, says a series of protests against alleged plans by the president to seek another mandate after the end of two full terms played a key role in Sall's decision to respect the constitutional order. His remarks come after the president publicly announced he will not seek a new term. This despite media reports that his supporters want him to seek a new mandate. Analysts say the decision of the president significantly eased political tensions in the country. For more reaction to the president's plan to hand over power next year, I reach Denis Ndour.
Well, first of all, we have to thank him for being courageous enough to face the reality of the work of democracy. As we know, before him, the former president Abdoulaye Wade did try to have a third term, but finally we have so many dead people because of protest. And as we know, he did swear twice as a president. That means that he already got his two terms. Of course, in his speech, he's trying to justify that he still have the right, but this is not the law that we have, the mother law, the constitution. It's very clear. It said that if you have two terms successively, you can have a third one.
So are you saying that human rights defenders and civil society organizations played a role in putting pressure on President Macky Sall not to seek a third unprecedented term?
Exactly, to respect the constitution. Because respecting the constitution is democracy. We cannot talk about democracy without respecting the constitution. And you know what happened in the sub-region, in Guinea or in Mali or in Ivory Coast, that every time the president tried to change in Burkina Faso to change the constitution or to violate the constitution, what happened is always what we know, trouble in the country. So we said that we have to work on that by writing to the president directly, but also by advocating, because what we want is peace. And to have to seek peace, you have to put what you need to put on the table, which means that justice, which means the respect of rules. Because most of the people who are trying to tell him that you can do it, I think those people, they just say it for their own interest.
Supporters of the president were arguing that the counter was set to zero when the constitution was amended, which they argued paves the way for the president to seek another term. You don't think their argument is legitimately right? Why?
No, it's not. It's not because we didn't have a new constitution. It's two different cases. If we take the previous president, he moved from a new constitution. So when we apply in law, we say we don't go back. So if you have a new constitution, that means that, well, we go back to the counter in zero. But in this case, it's not, because we had the constitution of 2001 said clearly that we have two terms. And then in the second, in the amendment of the constitution in 2016, it was not a matter of changing a constitution. It was only a matter of saying that we are doing making a lock to make sure no one even will think about a third term, because he added on the constitution saying that the constitution is for, you have two terms, and when you do two terms twice, you cannot have another one.
How are people, Senegalese people, how are they reacting so far to the president's decision not to seek a third term?
Actually, it's a kind of relief. People appreciate it, because even the day after the announcement, you can see when you go around with your car that the town changed. I mean, people are relieved that we're not going to have any protestation about the term. That means that people were expecting that decision. People were really, really expecting that decision. No one hesitated to open his business and go to school or do your own business, what you're supposed to do every single day. And we realized that days before, people were very scared of just opening their own business or, you know, in going to work or going in certain places, because people were saying, well, people can go for protesting anytime.
Denis Ndour is the vice president of the Senegalese Human Rights League. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Choosing the Hero, K. River Livingston's memoir, that detailed the account of her life and her relationship with former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is now being featured in the gift shop of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art in Washington. The book details the rise of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as the first elected female president of an African country. So far, no other African woman has been elected to the presidency of their nations. Sirleaf won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. River, who is an international consultant and lobbyist, also described in the book her experience working in some dangerous parts of the world, including Somalia. She says she was elated when she heard her book is on the shelves of the Smithsonian. The institution is known for its rigorous process in selecting the books it displays at its gift shops around the country. For more reaction, I reach out to Kay River Livingston here in Washington.
Peter, my reaction when I heard that my book was being featured by the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art was like disbelief, because I had not heard anything from my distributor and didn't have any awareness. And I got this text and somebody took a picture and they said, hey, congratulations, you're at the Smithsonian Museum of African Art. And I'm like, yeah, right. I just thought it was kind of a random joke or artificial intelligence or something that that wasn't real. And so I just got in my car, I went down, and I went there, and lo and behold, it was like one of four books, Peter, being featured, and really remarkable books side by side. And that's 7 years after the book was published. And so it says something to me about the staying power of the story.
How significant is this, knowing that you captured something about your journey through parts of Africa, and then to an extent, your relationship with former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is seen as a very important figure across Africa?
So I am, again, just going back, the book is called Choosing the Hero, My Improbable Journey and the Rise of Africa's First Woman President. But it's my memoir of 30 years on the continent, but captured in the friendship that I struck up with Madam President in 1996, and then went on to be her pro bono advisor, helped her return to Liberia in 97 to run against Charles Taylor, dealt with the aftermath of the destabilization of Liberia, the return to peace, the peacekeepers, the elections, and then her ultimate victory. So it's a pretty spectacular journey of this woman, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but again, through the eyes of someone who befriended her way back in 97. And so now, 2003, so 7 years after publication, and also, what, 17 years after her election, for it to be featured by the Smithsonian tells me that, you know, the story, not only about the resilience of Liberia and the woman, but also the power of friendship and the belief in something bigger than yourself, and to see where that carries you. So in some ways, Peter, I feel like it's the universality of the story that's carried even beyond Liberia.
Let me ask you about the impact of the relationship you had with the former president and the successes that the two of you chalked, partnering with each other, looking at the impact of the some of the policies that she implemented that you can see is generating enough momentum at the moment in Liberia.
So, great question, loaded question. I'd say that, you know, the first part of our relationship and the advocacy I provided was about making sure that the United States cared enough about what was happening in Liberia and the Civil War to vest its treasure, its troops, even if they were offshore, and its political power to stabilize the country. And I think that's, you know, one of the most significant milestones we achieved. Then the second milestone was the ability to effectively compete in that political process. And again, that was really when I was on ground with Madam President and or Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's candidate and doing her campaign and the historic success of her candidacy as the first and only woman elected president of the African continent. And still, unfortunately, that record stands. And I guess the third part, and I think that's what you're driving at, was the ability to commercialize the goodwill and the historic nature of President Sirleaf's victory and bring in the type of support that allowed Liberia to emerge as a post-conflict success story.
Kay River Levinson is an international consultant and lobbyist. She spoke with me from here in Washington. The General Secretary of the Uganda National Teachers Association says plans by the government to employ about 3,000 new teachers are not likely to resolve the shortage of teachers. Philbert Baguma says the government must first address issues with teachers who have been hired but are yet to be deployed. His remarks come after Henry Musasizi, the State Minister of Finance in charge of special duties, announced plans by the government to recruit about 3,000 new teachers across the country. This, he said, forms part of the administration's effort to fill the staffing gaps and improve quality education. But critics say the government should do more if education standards are to be improved. For more on the government's plan to recruit new teachers and its intended impact, I reach Philbert Baguma in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
First of all, if what they say is what they do, then I would be excited about that. Because right now, we have a number of teachers who were recruited and have not been deployed under the excuse of saying the government does not have money. And therefore, if that is not the case, then it is a welcome idea because we have a lot of staffing gaps in all education subsectors, be it primary, be it secondary, be it tertiary. The staff are not enough to handle the current enrollment.
You know, the government has to start somewhere and it needs financial resources. If it doesn't have money, how can it employ more teachers, like you are saying, to fill the gap? But isn't this a start?
It's a matter of prioritizing. You cannot say you want quality education in the absence of the teachers to handle the children or the learners. And therefore, in the event that you have a backlog of teachers who are recruited and not deployed, then you cannot start saying you want to recruit when those you recruited have not been deployed. So what we expect is government to be realistic and do what they say, not simply say things to appease stakeholders and then implementation is not going on. And that is the only issue we have.
Well, some are saying those are some of the red tapes. The government is working hard to address that. Your reaction to that?
Working hard is not seen in words. Working hard is seen through action. And therefore, when we say there is high enrollment in schools and the government does not see that as a priority, then the few teachers who are there will not provide quality education because of the overwhelming numbers. And therefore, we need to be realistic and say, yes, government may not have money, but you have to look at the priorities. And once you are looking at priorities, then you cannot say education is not a top priority for any serious government.
But the government has admitted that education is its number one priority, and that is why it has budgeted for these 3,000 teachers it wants to employ. They might not necessarily have all the money that it takes, but at least they are making effort. supporters of the NRM are saying that the government deserves commendation, at least for taking steps to address the staffing shortage of teachers to improve quality education.
That is what everyone would like to see. But we need not to hear words. We want to see action. Because as you talk, the learners are not attended to. I have told you there are teachers of secondary schools who were recruited, and then after recruiting, they said they don't have a budget for them. And therefore, before you provide for funds for recruiting, first deploy those you recruited, because those do not need a process now. There is nothing like a process of advertising and so on. They were recruited, they only await for documents to go to the field and teach. So let's have those deployed, and then we go through the process of recruitment of other teachers to bridge the staffing gaps which we have, because our children deserve better.
Philbert Baguma is the General Secretary of the Uganda National Teachers Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers with the James Webb Space Telescope Cosmic Evolution Early Release Science Survey have discovered the most distant active supermassive black hole to date. The black hole is in a galaxy identified as Ceres 1019 that was formed about 13.23 billion years ago, just over 570 million years after the Big Bang. The black hole, at 9 million solar masses, is not as enormous as any other that have been identified by other telescopes in the early universe. These other early supermassive black holes usually have masses that are more than a billion times that of the Sun. Scientists theorize that there are many of these supermassive black holes in the early universe, but were too dim to observe until the powerful JWST was put online. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Morocco made history on Saturday as they won their first Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations title with a thrilling 2-1 win against 10-man Egypt at the Mole Abdellah Stadium in Rabat, requiring extra time to settle the match. Both Morocco and Egypt have earned their spots in next year's Olympic Games, set to take place in Paris alongside Mali, who secured their qualification after defeating Guinea in the third-place playoff game on Saturday. Guinea can still secure a place as the fourth African side at the Olympic Games in Paris, but they have to win a playoff against the yet-to-be-decided Asian opponents. In tennis news, Tunisian tennis player Ons Jabeur qualified on Saturday for the round of 16 at the Wimbledon tennis tournament after defeating Canadian Bianca Andreescu 2-1, 3-6, 6-3, 6-4. Jabeur, who was in the finals in last year's tournament, will now play world number 9 and two-time Wimbledon champion Petra Kvitova on Sunday. In the previous rounds, Jabeur had made light work of her first two opponents, dropping just 8 games as she cruised through to the third round. In basketball, African basketball tournament got underway in Luanda, Angola on Saturday with 12 participating countries. The 12-nation event is reserved for African-based players, but for two. 2023 FIBA African host Angola made a loud and clear statement about their ambitions as they edge off Mali 72-55 in an evenly matched game for Group B.
DR Congo kickstarted their 2023 FIBA African campaign with a close yet convincing 70-63 win over Cameroon in Group D opener. In Group C, Tunisia defeated Rwanda 67-61 point. AFRICAN is a quadrennial competition that aims to give African-based players international basketball experience, but it also looks to promote the game across the continent. In athletics, Kenya's former world 1,500 meters champion Timothy Cheruiyot produced a dominant display to win the national trials on Saturday and vowed to recapture his world title in Budapest. The 2019 world champion and Tokyo Olympic silver medalist is relishing being back to full fitness after 2 years of injury that left him finishing only sixth at the World Championships in Eugene, Oregon. He ran a world-leading time of 3 minutes, 31.41 seconds in Los Angeles in May and followed that up with another tactical show at the Kenyan trials to clock 3 minutes, 34.1 seconds, beating the world indoor champion Abel Kipsang at the finish. And now to wrestling. The Nigerian Wrestling Federation contingent at the just concluded 2023 Spanish Grand Prix in Madrid won 2 gold and a bronze medal as part of the Wrestling Federation's preparations towards next year's Olympic Games in Paris. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Hopefully, African leaders and other concerned officials have been monitoring the very interesting debate in the Western world about their relationship with China as far as trade commerce is concerned. This debate was triggered a year ago when Secretary of State Blinken made a major speech on China. He remarked that only China could challenge United States power in the world. And for that reason, the United States would work hard with China on environmental matters, but on the other hand, it will challenge China on other matters. Then the debate became serious when the head of the European Union announced months ago that the European Union would follow a new policy of a decoupling with China in light of the experiences gained in the Ukraine war and the supply chain problems. After that speech, many European businessmen and women and the Trade Council came out with a statement that they would not support decoupling with China because China is so important to Europe, and also China has the largest market and is a major manufacturing hub. After the reaction of the French European business community, the head of the European Union came with some clarification. She said that Europe would abandon the idea of decoupling and instead will use de-risking. Not long after that statement, U.S. businessmen, women, and entrepreneurs said that they could not accept decoupling for China because of the same reasons given by the European business community. And now, Secretary Zeling, who's been in China and will be closing her trip today, Sunday, has told the audience in China that America is not supporting decoupling. Rather, she said, America wants a healthy relations with China in economic, commerce, and trade. What America wants to do is to making some changes in the various areas of its relationship, but not decoupling. He said it's too important for America. One high official, COL, in the United States even said that in trade, commerce, China and the United States are like conjoined twins. These are very interesting clarifications that have emerged because they will show Africa what they should do. They will also favor, as the markets have favored, that these clarifications are useful for world trade. And Africa would also find it very interesting, but would ask the world to give them also the benefit of the doubt that they, using their best judgment, should be able to trade and do business with whatever country they want without concern about ideological. And this is necessary at this juncture because of two coming events. One, the African-Russia summit in St. Petersburg coming soon, and the next BRIC summit meeting in August that will take place in South Africa. These meetings should be held as they are planned, but without accusing Africa for leaning to one side or the other. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
life, I wanna be with you, be with you. First I couldn't decide on getting married, but now with you. Miss women wherever. I'm so nervous, so nervous. I wanna be a happy man, yeah. Cause you make me a complete man, oh. Say I give them all to you. Let them start biting their finger. They can't compare themselves to you. I'm a banya boo, I'm a bayo tree. Chibononi. I've waited and waited and waited. All I wanted was who's dedicated. So when you came in the picture, I said I'll stay with you. Now I declare for you. I'm man enough to talk to your siblings and parents and carry you home. I know say the cocos I go flow, I know they care. I'm putting a ring on your finger, yeah. Girl, you deserve it. Cause you make me a complete man, oh.
I never find another lover like you. Many of them come to confuse my mind, but I'm not free to take your mind away from you. Nobody be find my love, and I'm addicted to the things you do. Me, whoa, never play them up with baby girl, no they be a challenge. Them all those videos, see they no fit touch body. All of the things you go see on the internet, oh. Don't let it play with your mind, cause God, I didn't give you my word.
My side, you know.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you only focus on beauty in your search for a wife, you will end up marrying a very beautiful problem. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.